Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who has both casual and formal golf shoes, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. So much to talk about, so little time. First off, last weekend's Tour Championship in Atlanta. One of the most amazing displays from a player, Tiger Woods, and that's saying something, and fans there at Eastlake that I've ever seen. Hollywood would not have written something like what we saw at the end of that tournament on the 18th green. We'll put it in perspective with golf historian Peter Kessler. Also, we'll talk Tiger a little bit with Sam Burns' caddy, David Woosley, whose man played side-by-side with the big cat earlier this year at the Honda. Also, we'll chat about Sam's great year and ascension to the PGA Tour full-time beginning next week in Napa. And it's Ryder Cup time. And after day one, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, and we'll discuss both with Fansided.com's Ron Mintz. But we begin with Peter Kessler. Peter, I'm so glad I got the chance to talk with you this week because you give me such great perspective. I am admittedly a Tiger fanboy at heart. The whole reason why I got into the game late in life like I did was I was fascinated watching what this guy did on a golf course. He may be one of my top three favorite athletes of all time. So I come at it from a very biased perspective. But when I was watching Sunday, I couldn't believe what I was seeing on an American golf course in Atlanta, one of the worst sports towns in America, where you had this throng of people spontaneously, you know, bum rushing the ropes, getting out on the fairways and following Tiger and Rory up the 18th green. Normally, this sort of thing is reserved for the Open Championship. There may be some images from Baltusrol with Jack back in 80, but I have never seen anything like that before in golf. Have you?
Well, you know, when Bobby Jones was at the peak of his powers was the time during which they started to put up ropes on the sides of the fairways instead of a rope that would go across the fairway and hold the crowd back, a little like we saw last Sunday with Tiger and Rory, except there was no rope. So, you know, Jones's crowds were as crazy about Jones as Tiger's crowds are about him, as Arnold's crowds were about him. And, of course, you know, you mentioned the Open Championship and guys having to work their way out of the crowd and to come forward like the guys did at the Tour Championship. And, you know, we have great memories of Arnold doing that and pretending that he'd hurt himself in the process. And we've seen Tom Watson the year that he smoked the two iron in the early 80s to win another Open Championship, had to emerge from the pack. So, you know, that's reserved for, you know, the really special people. And so, yes, it was fantastic. And I think, you know, there's been a tremendous pent-up wish by millions and millions of people around the world to see Tiger Woods successfully have a second act. You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald said there's no second acts in American life, but we're certainly seeing one here with Tiger. And if he does nothing else after this last week, it will have been a successful second act, getting to his 80th win, winning 5 years after his last victory, the most exciting thing we've seen on the golf course in 10 years since he won the playoff over Rocco in 08. So I just thought it was magnificent. And I'm like you, I've been a Tiger fan really right from the very beginning. And, you know, and I've had, you know, I've been very lucky. I had a lot of interaction with Tiger. You know, when he was 20, we did his first TV show together, 90 Minutes Live, and that went particularly well. And we did, I don't know, 8 or 10 hours additionally over the years. And he's never gone back to anybody else's studios, never gone back to the Golf Channel. I was the only guy that he trusted. And I just wish I was in a position now to have a platform where I could interview him on camera, because I think he would definitely say yes, and he trusts me. So I was very excited about the whole thing, and I'm excited about his future.
You brought up Rory McIlroy, and I got to thinking about a couple of things over the weekend. David Duval may have the most prescient quote of the year from back early in the spring, where he was talking about some of the younger players lamenting that, oh, I wish I could have gotten some of Tiger in his prime. I wish I could face that guy. And he looked at him and said, the hell you do. And there was a lot of talk about how these guys don't fear Tiger, and they don't look at him like the other players did. And then the Open Championship came, and I watched Jordan Spieth and a whole lot of other people outside of Francesco Molinari fold like cheap suits. And then I saw the PGA Championship with everybody but Brooks Koepka folding like a cheap suit. And then in successive days, on Saturday and Sunday, the number one player in the world, Justin Rose at the time, got his tail handed to him. Rory McIlroy, even worse, on Sunday. I think the whole Tiger intimidation thing is in full effect, Peter.
It's never gone away. It's taken me a while to figure out how to utilize Twitter, and at first, I didn't even realize that my replies were public. I thought they were going to the other person. So I really did a bad job of getting educated before I started tweeting. And then I found myself getting into arguments with folks. And then I decided, gee, that was fun. I'm going to be the Twitter sniper. And a couple of months ago, 6 weeks ago, I decided, no, I'm going to do it differently on Twitter. I'm going to be amusing, and I'm going to have my sense of humor, and I'm going to do golf history, and I'm going to present the person that I used to present, say, on the Golf Channel and or on radio. And, you know, Rex Hoggard at the Golf Channel comes out with an article, you know, in between the Open and the PGA, saying Tiger had completely lost his intimidation factor. And, you know, I said to him, you know, you do realize, of course, that the minute that Tiger made the two early birdies at the Open is exactly when Jordan discombobulated, imploded, and made a triple to take himself out of the golf tournament. You know, and I gave him a couple of other examples, and I've gotten into wars with people who say that the factor is gone. The factor's never gone anywhere. He just hadn't played well enough for it to be able to kick in until right now, when it was in full effect, because he was able to emerge as the winner. He, whatever it was he had to figure out about getting the last four or six holes of a round done the way that the first group of holes were done, somehow he figured out what he had to work through and did it this last week to, you know, he got close at the Open, he got closer at the PGA, and of course now he's burst through, and the intimidation factor is in full flight. I mean, when Tiger birdied the first hole against Rory, that was ridiculous. Rory just was all over after one hole. And then, of course, it was completely over with Rose on the Saturday when Tiger birdied six of the first seven. And I don't understand how any of the numbers work. I'm sorry. I mean, you know, Justin Rose screws up a tournament, screws up the playoff, and becomes number one. Then he goes to the next tournament, and he has a chance to do something cool, win $10 million, play a good round of golf, maybe even win the golf tournament as well, shoots a zillion, and acted as though he had just shot 59. I became such a non-fan of Justin after that round, I couldn't believe it. In him accepting all these congratulations, he played like a pig down the stretch, and he was totally intimidated by Tiger, and he's not Hall of Fame material, as my good buddy Alan Shipnuck pointed out earlier on Wednesday of this week. And so I think his intimidation factor is in full flow, and there's no question his interest level is going to be maintained. And if he can keep his body in shape and keep the swing he's got now, which I like his swing as much as the swing of 2000, I think the sky's the limit. There's no difference between winning a major, in my view, and what he did this last week, and I don't think there's an additional degree of difficulty. Normally, you would say that a golf tournament like he won last week is like being on a high wire 10 feet above the ground, but there's a net. A major championship is like being 60 feet above the ground on a high wire, but there's no net. That would apply to everybody except to Tiger. In his mind, there won't have been any difference between what happened this past week and what he's capable of doing going forward. He's not going to think, okay, now there's one more level. The level was winning. He's got there. He knows how to do this. It was like watching a major championship. It was like watching Tiger with a Saturday night major lead, and he just goes ahead and puts the ball into the right places on the Sunday, hitting cut shots off the tee, making three-quarter swings, hitting the ideal shot at every single occasion in the greens. It was magnificent, and he's been the best iron player, well, since he burst on the scene 24 years ago, and he remains the best iron player today. This last week, he's putting the ball in play, and lately he's been getting the ball in play more. He puts the ball in play. Forget it. It's 2000 all over again, and he's almost 43.
Golf historian Peter Kessler is our guest taking Dead Aim. I'm glad you brought up Tiger as far as his accuracy. The last 2 weeks, both at Aronimink and then at the Tour Championship, there's been multiple rounds of 11 to 14 fairways, 10 to 14, 12 to 14. Even in his prime, with the exception of the 2000 season, Tiger was never the most accurate guy off the tee. I mean, 8 or 9 out of 14 was a pretty typical Tiger Woods round. I'm with you. When he's striping the middle of the fairway or the right or left side of the fairway, hitting beautiful on-balance drives with the big stick, there's nobody that's going to stay with him.
Well, you know, when he was winning his major championships, it coincided with my time basically on the Golf Channel, and so I went to 11 of the 14, and except for the Masters where you can't go inside the ropes, I'm inside the ropes, and there were very few members of the press that would go from a green to the next tee to watch him hit, because you had to go like 100 yards in the wrong direction away from the hole, and the guys would go and stand where the balls were going to land. But I always thought my grandmother could have hit the ball where it's landing. You can't even see the guy hit it from the tee. So I always went to the tee, and I always went to the back of the tee, and I always knelt down 10, 11 feet behind Tiger, unobstructed view, exactly on his ball target line, just like we were playing golf at home, that when where you would stand if you weren't standing on the side. And I've seen him play, obviously, you know, a few hundred par three holes. And during that time, I used to play a game with myself. I would get down and wait for it to be Tiger's turn, and I would watch him look assess the situation, and I would assess the situation, and I would say, okay, if you're Tiger and you're in this situation where he is right this second, wherever it was, what's the absolute perfect shot that you hit here? How high does it go? How far does it go? How much does it curve? How close to the hole does it end up? Where does it start relative to the center of the green before it starts to curve one way or the other? And I used to play that game in my head, and then I would watch him get up and hit the shot. And 8 out of 10 times he would hit the shot that I had in my mind. But I don't mean just hit the shot. I mean the exact space through the sky that I imagined it. He had his choice of 9 different flights, you know, high, medium, low, right, straight, left. Whether it's a draw or a hook was up to the swing at the time, or a fade or a slice. You know, he could curve it as much as he wanted, but he had 9 shots at his disposal that he was comfortable hitting under pressure. A lot of guys will have stuff in practice rounds, as Lee Trevino used to tell me. He said that Lee, was pretty much the only guy who would do stuff on the golf course that he would do at home that nobody would think about doing on the golf course. So, you know, so Tiger would give you the ideal shot, and I feel like he's doing it again.
Peter, you brought up Justin Rose, and I'm glad you did, because I don't think he has taken near the criticism that he deserves about this. I thought it was a clown show. It is one of the things that people point out as a turnoff to them in the game of golf, and that people are in it for the money and not for winning. He played like a dog on Saturday, maybe played even worse on Sunday. And when he got that lucky break of the ball going forward on the 18th instead of falling back in the bunker, and he was able to two-putt birdie and actually win the FedEx Cup overall, the fist pump and the exuberant behavior, I was stunned by it. I was like, oh my gosh, has no one told you that you've lost today? I mean, it seemed like a clown show to me, Pete.
Well, I took out the last barf bag that I had that I actually saved from Trump Airlines when the shuttle was in place, and I used to collect those on the one trip that I went, and I got violently ill, and some called it projectile vomiting. I wasn't really sure. And I just thought it was disgraceful. I mean, the whole system is a complete mess. When you can screw up a tournament and then you become number one, something's wrong. When you can screw up a tournament and get a $10 million check, something is wrong. And then people talk about him being in the Hall of Fame with 9 PGA Tour wins and a major at the age of 40, and somebody with a history of not really closing very much. And to me, the gold medal at the Olympics is worth less than a PGA Tour win, quite frankly. Nobody got excited about golf because the presentation was so poor, which is always the problem. It's the presentation that's bad. And nobody really cared about that, and the format wasn't good, and there weren't really a lot of good players. And, you know, I said to Jack Nicklaus, nobody's going to care. And Jack said, you're wrong. He said, there's places in the world where people covet a gold medal more than they do a trophy for winning a tournament. I said, yeah, but not one of those people is going to be alive and watching this because it's unwatchable, and you can't watch Olympic golf coverage and think that there's anything about it that appears to be of interest that you would participate in. And so we had a really great conversation about it, and the last time I ran into him, I said, you haven't seen any numbers that the game has grown because of the Olympics. I said, because it's the presentation that doesn't work that makes it look so unattractive.
Get you out of here on this. Golf historian Peter Kessler, our guest taking Dead Aim. Moving forward to this week, the Ryder Cup. Outside of the Masters, this is my favorite event, big-time event in golf. There's lots of talk about how Tiger's overall record isn't good. His singles record is 4-2-1. This is sort of a newer Tiger in terms of camaraderie with not only his teammates in the locker room at the Ryder Cup, but throughout the year. And you could see when he walked off the green at Eastlake, guys who had been playing with him down at the Medalist Club, Fowler and JT, they were there to shake his hand and tell him how much it meant to see him accomplish this. And I thought that was great. Do you think that that might translate into better team result for Tiger in the Ryder Cup?
I don't think anything has any bearing on anything to do with what will happen tomorrow. I don't think that what happened last week means anything about what will happen this weekend. I don't think past performance is any indicator of future performance. When Tiger finished second at the PGA, a nice young sports writer who's really just a casual fan, and that's the problem with today's golf journalists, wrote immediately after he finished second, he said, I've got Tiger finishing in the top three at Augusta next year. And I said, that's 250 days. Three seasons and 25 tournaments away. You don't know how you're going to play today, let alone how you're going to play at a golf tournament where you don't know what the weather is next spring, three seasons away. There's no way to know. That's why you let them play. Dustin Johnson, big favorite, going over to the Open Championship, head lob wedge into every single hole for 2 days, missed the cut. There's no way to know how anyone will play. That said, I think the Tiger's going to be nice and relaxed. I think Tiger's going to be his normal, confident self. I think Tiger is going to see this as a good international goodwill sporting exhibition, as I do, as Jack Nicklaus does. I don't take any of this war stuff very seriously. You know, you've got the top 10 players in the world, so it should be terrific. And I think 21 of the top 24, so that's pretty cool, or 20 of the top 24 players in the world. So you've got super field. So there's no way to know how any of them will play. And that's, of course, why we let them play, and which is why, of course, this idea of starting the Tour Championship next year with 30 players where the leader is 10 under means that the Tour doesn't believe in the product. It means they don't believe that a 72-hole tournament with the 30 best players in the world duking it out for a single prize isn't attractive enough for people who play golf. And that's a big, big worry for me when the commissioner of the Tour doesn't believe in his product, as the commissioner of the European Tour doesn't understand his product because he's not a golfer. He's a marketer, so he's trying to think of other ways to show the game of golf. There isn't another way. There's these six-hole matches, the thing where you've got 30 seconds to hit your shot. Those are just gimmicks. But they say that the people at the highest levels of the tours don't know who their audience is, don't know what their audience wants, and that they don't really believe in their product, and that's a worry.
He's one of my favorite people in the game, golf historian Peter Kessler. Up next, Sam Burns' caddy and longtime friend of the show, David Woosley, takes dead aim at Tiger's progression this year. They played with him at the Honda. And Sam's ascension to the PGA Tour beginning next week. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoor.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors, and joined now by longtime friend of the show and Sam Burns' caddy, David Woosley. David, before we start talking about Sam and the great year that you guys had and what's ahead for you two, especially in the not-too-distant future, I want to hit on a couple of things. We talked early on in the year after you spent a round of golf. I think it was at the Honda. The final round of the Honda was Sam playing with Tiger Woods. And I remember talking with you at the time. And I said, well, what kind of condition is his game in? And you said, well, you can see some of it, but there's still a long way to go. Based on what you saw at the Honda and what we're now seeing, how big is that distance? How big is that transformation from that part of the year until now?
Well, I mean, I think it's monumental because at the Honda, just for instance, Joe LaPava's a friend of mine, Tiger's caddy, and I was asking him during the round, you know, what's your schedule? And he literally said, I don't know. And I think at that time they'd only played a few tournaments. And they weren't sure, you know, what his body could take. And so they were just kind of going week to week. Also, during his play, Tiger's play, I got the feeling like last year, three or four holes, you know, he was being aggressive at some pins just to see if he could do it. Meaning, you know, he's under the gun. There was a lot of attention there, obviously. And I know the next to last par three, he hit it in the water. But I don't know. I just really admired what he was doing. I thought he was trying to go right at that pin, you know, water be damned type thing. And so he's just been making, you know, great progress, and obviously, and culminating in a terrific win. And on top of that, excuse me. I feel like you know, this is just a great thing for the tour, and I'm going to tell Sam Burns it's a great thing for him because, you know, Sam has big aspirations. He wants to be a top 10 player. He wants to win majors, and, you know, I think he's already done well around Tiger, and if this is, the last 4 or 5 years of Tiger's, you know, powerful career, then Sam Burns is going to be a part of that. This is the first few years of his career, and hopefully his dreams will, you know, come true.
Looking back on this year, if you were to ask Sam where it ranked, how big of a highlight in his golfing life do you think it is that he got to play 18 holes of golf with Tiger Woods?
Well, I mean, first of all, 18 holes on basically Tiger's home track. I mean, that's not his home course, but he lives in the area. This is Florida, of course. And when we teed off, you know, both guys had an outside chance to win, maybe. I don't remember how far back we were. I think we were in seventh place or something like that, tied with Tiger. And so, you know, all systems are on go big time, and Sam, you know, played great. And so I couldn't tell you how high it is, but it still has to be in the top three, and I don't know what two or three would be.
Now, rumor has it that walking off that first tee, your man looked at Tiger and said, isn't it great that all these people showed up to see me? Is that true?
That is true, and I didn't know that until, like, the next day. there's a picture, yeah, in the paper, and you could see Johnny LaCava was behind Tiger and Sam, and I was about 10 paces behind, and I saw him chuckling, and I thought that was a good sign because I really believe that Tiger Woods likes to talk, you know, when he competes. I told Sam that Tiger Woods communicated, but you kind of had to, you had to be the one to initiate it. And I guess that's the way things got started with a good chuckle.
David Woosley, Sam Burns' caddy. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's talk about your man a little bit. When last we were together was at Quail Hollow, and I believe y'all had a great Thursday and or Friday. You were right there in terms of getting enough money to where Sam could stay out on the big tour after Quail. It didn't go as planned, and so you had to finish out the season on the web.com, which... You know, look, no big deal. You were able to really move up your status. I think you finished fourth on the money list. But was that a period of disappointment for Sam, or was it one of those things that he said, ah, man, we gave it our best effort, but we're going to finish out strong on the web.com? I know you have a psychology degree. How did you play that with him?
You know, the answer to that question is both are true. You know, he was frustrated, and yet he was also saying, let's move on. You know, it's frustrating, particularly, for instance, at Tampa. I think we were in third place on the 16th tee, and anything, you know, top five there would have gotten it done, and didn't get it done there, didn't get it done in Charlotte. And so, obviously, we needed to go on the web. Sam finished fourth, I guess, total money when you add the web.com final four, but... we just kind of stumbled in there and finally decided to, you know, go home for a little bit and get some rest. But he finished second in the regular season, and we feel really good about that. So we're looking forward to next week, which is Tampa.
Now, talk to me a little bit about the way it works in terms of seeding, because not all exemptions on the PGA Tour are equal. Because you finished second in the regular season or fourth in the overall money list, you guys are pretty much exempt into everything that you could possibly be exempt into, yes?
Yeah, until the end of this calendar year. That's my understanding, is, you know, that you have to, there's a reshuffle after, I don't know if it's five or eight tournaments or something like that. And you have to play to a certain standard. And I'm assuming that we got to do that the rest of the year. But, you know, if Sam just plays his normal game, that's not going to be a concern. But he's certainly not taking anything for granted. So, the only thing I know is I guess they have two. The winner of the web.com regular season, the fellow from Korea, and then the winner of the overall money, both of those guys are fully exempt, including TPC in Jacksonville, which is a big deal. But other than that, you know, we've just got to keep playing good golf, and, you know, Sam's a good player, and so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, David, as I look at your results in the middle of summer, starting at the 1st of July, I mean, T11, 3rd, T14, T7, third. You guys got on a really nice roll there in the summer, and then it's like you said, it's almost like you got to August and your kid just kind of ran out of gas. Is there such a thing as, even though he's a young guy, is there such a thing of maybe playing too much?
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely. I've worked for a lot of young guys, and they're all guilty of that, thinking that just because they're, you know, 20 whatever, that they're bulletproof, and but it doesn't show up until Sunday, and if you do it, especially if you're doing really well, because it's the mental stuff that kind of seems to crumble first. But obviously, if you get on a regular schedule 2 or 3 weeks at a time and then take a week or two off, you can do it. But I remember, I think Chip Beck was, he was a great player, and we played, and he was playing great, and we played the U.S. Open in San Francisco back in the day, and I remember, you know, this was his sixth tournament in a row, and you just knew it wasn't going to go well, and we missed the cut, and I think that's exactly what happened to Sam. When you're going at it full bore the way he does, you don't even allow the thought that you need some rest to come in there, because he felt like that he needed to do that to secure his spot. And once our spot was secured, it's natural to kind of have a letdown. So that's what happened.
So your schedule going forward, you say you're back in action next week. Did you learn along the way, okay, Sam, we're going to be out for 3 weeks tops at a time, or is it 4 weeks? What do you think his limits are?
I think he's a smart guy, and he wants to be, you know, able to bring everything he has every time he tees up, just which is what Tiger has talked about for, you know, his whole playing life. So I would imagine that we'll play three, maybe four in a row if we have to. And by the way, we're going to play Napa, and then there's 2 weeks off that we're not going to play overseas. And then there is four in a row. I think it's Jackson, Mississippi, Las Vegas, Mexico, and then the island.
Right.
And he'll be good for all of those. I'm 100% confident of that. But you wouldn't want to go four in a row, take a week off, three in a row, stuff like that. I mean, that just beats you up.
David Woosley is Sam Burns' caddy. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Want to ask you about the Ryder Cup real quick. We've talked about it before. You were with Chip for the War on the Shore. And as I watch preparation getting ready for this week, I always think of questions for you. And the preparation for a caddy, it's different for the Ryder Cup. And we were swapping messages off air. You say in some ways it's a little easier because, unlike every other event, you've got 11 other caddies and you guys are sort of pooling your resources.
Yeah, so, I mean, some excuses if you get in a room with the rest of the guys, particularly the ones that you're close to, and, you know, just verify that all these numbers are correct, you know, looking at slopes and landing areas and see if there's an impact there, if there's, you know. So, I mean, you should have everything and be completely comfortable, you know, the first competitive round. So, you know, and then on top of that, the players, I think they've mentioned that on TV recently, you know, that they're not exactly, at least the first of the week, going at it because they're tired. And so that's perfect. They might have just played 9 holes on Tuesday. I don't know. Some of them up, probably. But anyway, that's the perfect opportunity to have, have 3 or 4 hours out there by yourself with other caddies, you know, looking at strategic placement of shots and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's easier in that sense, but there's definitely a lot of energy there. The very first tee, the very first day, it feels like a heavyweight fight and just people screaming. I mean, it's hard to stay calm.
Dumb caddy question coming up right here. When you're when you're preparing, when you're out doing your measurements and whatever for the golf course, every golf course in the world has things measured out 250, 200, 150, 100. What when you look at a hole, where are places that you look to that I need to get a measurement from here? What is something that you see visually that tells you I better go over here and get a measurement from this point? Are there certain landmarks you look for on a hole?
Well, here's kind of my dumb answer, which is I look for everything. I don't, you know, that's just the way I do it. And I try to spend as much time on the course as possible, meaning, I mean, just because I have all the yardage, that's a great thing. But I need to be on the course watching other players, you know, how the ball lands in the fairway, on the green, stuff like that. And so I have yardage books that I've had for, you know, five or 10 years. And, you know, surprisingly enough, at some point, you know, you'll find a number that you, wow, I don't have that number. And strangely enough, and I can't remember where it was, but it might have been Boise where somebody hit a ball so far left of the other fairway, and they had a number from a sprinkler head in the opposite fairway to the front of the green in your fairway. And I was thinking, I don't have that one. You see what I'm saying? Like, it's like a parallel fairway. You missed it so bad, you got into the other fairway, and you needed that number, and this caddy had it, and I didn't have it.
I don't know what that says about that caddy's confidence in his man that he's measuring things from other fairways.
Seriously.
You're going to see a lot from Sam Burns in the not-too-distant future, and on the bag, that man, David Woosley. And when we return, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times yesterday in France. And Fansided.com's Ron Mintz takes dead aim at both initial sessions of the Ryder Cup. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. A couple of centuries ago, a writer once said about France, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. That was true yesterday with Sessions 1 and 2 of the Ryder Cup. And to discuss it, Fansided.com's Ron Mintz.
Ron, it was a tale of two sessions on Friday at the Ryder Cup. Let's start with the best of times before we get to the worst of times. The morning session, the four ball, everything was going great. Even Tiger and Captain America, Reed, they weren't terrible. Tiger looked a little uncomfortable. He looked like somebody who has a stiff back in 50-degree weather, but that's not uncommon for any of us. They just ran in. You know, Fleetwood got hot down the stretch and made, you know, I think back-to-back holes of 20-plus foot of birdie putts. You know, what are you going to do? That happens in match play. I felt really good coming out of that 3-1 with one exception. I could not for the life of me figure out why Furyk rested Bubba and Phil in the four ball and brought them back for the foursomes, the alternate shot. Because you got to hit the fairway, and neither one of those two guys are known for hitting a lot of fairways, especially Phil, who I have a feeling could stand on Normandy Beach right now and not put it in the ocean with a driver.
Yeah, he's ranked next to last in accuracy off the tee on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, what did I see? There's 193 players that are ranked, and Phil, it's 192?
That's exactly right.
Oh, it was awful. I was looking on Twitter and on social media. People were going nuts about DeChambeau, and I felt bad for DeChambeau. I don't think we can judge DeChambeau. I don't think the good Lord himself could have hit second shots from where Phil was placing him. It was terrible.
Yeah, it was terrible, and you know, DJ hit some bad tee shots as well.
Well, and he got in trouble. He couldn't make a 4 or 5 foot putt to save his life in the afternoon. There were several different occasions where he could have halved a hole with par, and just couldn't make the putt.
Well, thank God for Jordan Spieth, a putter working this morning, because you know, we got those points.
Well, and you know what? That one scared me, though, because, you know, Spieth made a couple of bombs, and he chipped in, and they were 3 or 4 up, and then I left the room for a little bit, and I came back, and all of a sudden that match was all square again, and I'm going, whoa, what happened here? But that was an interesting finish. In fact, Justin Rose, his second shot into that 18th hole was a bullet right at the flag. It looked great. In fact, it kind of reminded me of Tom Watson's shot into the 18th hole at Turnberry when he almost won the British Open a few years ago, or the Open Championship a few years ago, in that it was the perfect shot. It just came in too hot, and it went in, he rinsed it on the other side of the hole. You know, otherwise, that match probably would have ended in a half, but there was lots of things in the morning session to be happy about, but that afternoon session, Ron, whew.
Yeah, it's first time, I guess, I think the first time we've ever been swept in the foursomes. I mean, we've not done well in the foursomes, but we hadn't lost them all. And I think it's the first time that's ever happened.
Well, you know, and it used to be the complaint that, well, the American team doesn't have any team chemistry. They don't really hang out together. They don't like you. I don't want to hear that now. These guys hang out with each other all the time. They live down the street from one another. They're in each other's weddings. They're going on spring break together. There's not a chemistry issue on this team. What we had a problem with in the foursome session was we had some terrible ball striking and putting issues. That's the only issue there is.
Yeah, and Europe's got 5 rookies on their team, and they're kicking our butts. I don't understand it. I just don't. You know, it's the same thing every year. We think, well, we don't care as much as Europe does. And I do think Europe embraces the Ryder Cup more. I don't know why. But they really want it worse than we do. Why they do, I don't know why, but they do. They really want it worse than we do. And you don't hear anything about the ping pong table in their team room. You know, they take it pretty serious.
You know, there's two guys on that European team, and I have decided that they literally could have reports out there that says neither one has broken 80 in a year and a half. But come Ryder Cup time, Sergio Garcia is going to look like Seve in his prime, and Ian Poulter is going to start making putts and making that Ian Poulter crazy face on TV, and everybody's going to start singing ole, ole, ole. I mean, those two guys, and it seems someone brought this up to me on Twitter. those two guys are just the latest in a line of European guys. And to your point, that not only embraced the Ryder Cup, but have excelled at the Ryder Cup. There was Seve. There was Ollie. There was Montgomery. There was Faldo. Now you've got Poulter. You've got Sergio. You've got guys that live to compete in the Ryder Cup, it seems. And, you know, I was thinking back in American Ryder Cup history. Okay, there was Raymond Floyd. There was Larry Nelson. There was Lanny Watkins. And now I'm stumped, and I've turned back the clock almost 40 years to find those guys.
Right. And you look at the points for the European team, I think Sergio was like 21st, and Poulter was 23rd. And I'm thinking, well, there's no way they can pick the captain's pick that far back. But there was never any doubt they were going to pick them for exactly what you said. They turn it on. When the Ryder Cup starts, they're different players. If they could play that way all year round, they'd be number one and two in the world.
Well, I always said if Colin Montgomery could make some of the putts in major championships that he made in the Ryder Cup, we'd be talking about Colin Montgomery with eight majors at this point.
Yeah. I don't know what it is now. In this tournament, I do think Europeans have an advantage because of that course, and they've got it set up to their advantage. You know, they've taken the length out of it where our bombers are having to hit irons, and, you know, the rough and everything. So they've definitely set the course up to their advantage. But, you know, hey, we do the same thing, so you can't say anything about that.
Yeah, no, that course right now is set up nasty. When you see guys like Rory McIlroy who have, you know, 130-mile-an-hour clubhead speed and they can't advance the ball out of the rough more than 2 feet, like I watched on Friday morning, you've got some serious issue. Fansided.com, Ron Mintz is the golf writer with Fansided.com. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. We're talking about the Ryder Cup. I was critical of Thomas Bjorn with his captain's pick. You brought up Sergio and you brought up Ian Poulter, and the captain's pick, another one was made, Henrik Stenson. And I was like, you know, I don't know if at this point you make the choice of experience over whoever's playing well. And in this case, Rafa Cabrera Bello and other guys, Thomas Peters, they were on form with their game when the time the captain's picks were made. It's hard for me to argue with Captain Bjorn at this point. He seems to have made all the right moves.
Yeah, I think Stenson was an excellent pick. I mean, he has ups and downs, but when it's on the line, he comes up and plays very well. And I didn't have a doubt that Henrik would play well. And, you know, Molinari's continuing to play. You know, he had two wins near the end of the season. And
well, he won the two most prestigious events on the European Tour, the Open Championship and the BMW Championship, which is their equivalent of the TPC. So as far as European golf goes, he's their player of the year.
He is. I mean, he's got a new coach or psychological coach, changed his whole attitude to playing one shot at a time. He says it's totally changed his game, and he's sticking with it. And I tell you, when he won the Open, he had that look in his eyes. It's just amazing. You see that sometimes in players. I don't think he even noticed anybody else was there but him. He was so focused. So it didn't surprise me that he played well. You know, Vegas had it right on the money. They said that the U.S. would win three matches this morning, Europe would lose one, and that's exactly what happened. I don't know what they predicted for this afternoon. But,
surely nobody would have predicted a shellacking. I mean, when it first started out, I said at best we could finish 2-2. And then about halfway through it, I said we'll be lucky if we're 4-4 at the end of this day. And it turned out, you know, we were 3-5 at the end of the day. They got out a big old broom and took care of business. It was an unbelievable performance by the European Ryder Cup team. Ron Mintz, golf writer with Fansided.com, our guest taking Dead Aim. We're talking Ryder Cup. And you bring up Francesco Molinari. The wind started kicking up a little bit in France yesterday, at times gusting to 15 and 20 miles an hour. And one thing that is said about Francesco is that he hits as straight a ball as anybody in the game of golf. And when you're playing in windy conditions and you can hit that boring straight ball and not have to worry about the wind affecting the way you're curving it, I think that's got to be an advantage. And, you know, it proved to be at the Open Championship.
Yeah, and I don't understand why, you know, players want to cut the ball or want to draw the ball. I mean, I know on certain holes it's an advantage, but I've always been taught that you can't ever go wrong hitting it straight, and that's exactly what he does.
Then again, and, Ben Hogan says the hardest thing in the world was to hit a ball straight, so maybe that's why not too many of us do it.
And they said, and Mick Faldo said the only shot Bubba Watson couldn't hit was a straight one. So, you know, to each his own, I guess. But yeah, Molinari, he does hit it. He strives it. I mean, just straight down the fairway.
Famously, in 1999, Mark James, the captain of the European Ryder Cup team, had three guys on his team: Jarmo Sandelin, Andrew Coulthard, and John Vandeveld. None of those three saw the light of day until the singles competition on Sunday. Now, they all three got shellacked, but his strategy was, I can't afford to have them in the foursomes or the fourball. They're not there. Their games aren't there. So he hid them as best he could. Based on what you've seen the last 2 weeks of the FedEx Cup and what we saw in the foursomes competition with Phil Mickelson, does he ride the pine all day on day two, and we don't see him until Sunday? Does Captain Furyk have the stroke to actually do that?
That's the big question. I was on Twitter a while ago, and I said, you know, Jim Furyk's a great guy, really nice guy, but I don't think he is the kind of guy that will go in that team room tonight and just give them a kick in the butt kind of talk and you know, let him have it. I don't think he can do that. Whether he can sit Phil down, because Phil's very vocal and he usually gets his way, but he should sit down tomorrow. I don't think he should play at all.
Well, the last guy that walked in there and tried to treat him like men and yell at him a little bit was Tom Watson, and look what he got for his trouble at the end of that Ryder Cup.
Well, you know, maybe that's our problem. We try to be buddies and instead of winning. And there's got to be a median there somewhere. And obviously I think Watson did take it a little bit too far, but I don't think other captains have taken it far enough. Furyk said in the beginning that it didn't matter, you know, what you'd done in the past or who you were. He was going to pick the best players. He certainly didn't line them up right today. I don't know what he was thinking with Phil. That was, when you said hide him, I thought, well, that might have been a good place to hide him, but no, it wasn't.
Ron Mintz is a writer with Fansided.com, the golf writer. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. In terms of personnel decisions, there was another one that I found highly questionable. I realize that Brooks Koepka has only won one tour event outside of his major championships. I get that. But what that tells me is that Brooks Koepka is a big game player. I just don't know if I would have sat a guy who won two major championships this year for any session. Brooks Koepka is young. He's a bull. He hits it a mile. He hits it straight. You don't win at the places that he has won without being able to hit the ball in the fairway and not in the rough. I found his benching in the foursomes to be one of the more questionable things, even more than playing Mickelson in the foursomes.
I agree. I mean, he's probably the fittest player out there. So as far as, you know, being able to play five matches, you know, in all five, if anybody could have done it, he could do it. Even better than Dustin. So I just didn't get it. I mean, he should have been out there. I'd have played him every time I could. So I agree. I don't know what I'm anxious to see what Furyk says in his presser about why he did that and why he let Phil play. I want to hear the reason behind that.
Historically speaking, we excel excel in the singles portion of the Ryder Cup. Even Tiger Woods, who has a meh sort of Ryder Cup record, is 4-2-1 in the singles. That being said, what deficit should the United States team still be at a deficit heading into the singles? What deficit is too great to overcome?
I don't know. Was it 2 years ago, Charlie, when we had that big lead?
We had a four. Four has been overcome by each side.
Yeah, we had a huge lead and ended up getting beat. So I wouldn't want more than a four deficit. I mean, that's probably all we could stand.
From fansided.com, that's Ron Mintz. I'd also like to thank Sam Burns' caddy, David Woosley, and golf historian Peter Kessler for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Also, a great way to stay in the loop with us, be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there right now, articles all about the Ryder Cup, including a great prank Tiger Woods played on Andrew Coulthard, who he played back in the 1999 Ryder Cup. You got to check that out. Hey, weather-wise, I think we're going to be okay in the QC, so it should be a good weekend to get your golf on. And if you do tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at CLT_golf guy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.